Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and it's sequester budget day minus one in America. Let's see if there's any movement toward a last-minute deal or what bogging down in a post-sequester world might be like with the new Democratic senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, who was elected in November to succeed Joe Lieberman. Senator, congratulations one more time on your election. Unfortunately, your booby prize is now you have to govern around the sequester. How does it feel?
Yeah, there are certainly some days where you wonder why you fought so hard for 2 years to get this job, given the nonsense that, you know, we're perpetuating here. You know, listen, this is idiotic. I was a member of the House of Representatives when I voted against this deal that set up the sequester. It seems like ancient history now, but, you know, about a year and a half ago, the Republicans refused to increase the borrowing limit of the federal government, which had basically been an administrative function that the House and the Senate carried out in a bipartisan way for years and years and years under Republican and Democratic presidents, and the Republicans decided they were going to end that. And so the way out of that potential economic catastrophe at the time was to set up this Rube Goldberg-like process in which a super committee was formed to try to find savings, and if they didn't find savings, then automatic cuts went into place, which we postponed for 2 months, and now we are back at an impasse. And the people that I talked to in Connecticut are just sick and tired of these perpetual cliffs coming up. They're sick and tired of these dumb budget cuts hanging over their heads. I just think we should postpone them and have a more reasonable adult conversation about how we achieve deficit reduction that's smart. And deficit reduction that's smart is balanced. It's a little bit of increased taxes on people who can afford it. It's a little bit of budget cuts. Actually, it's probably a lot of both, but it's not just across-the-board spending cuts that have absolutely no relation to what accounts can bear the strain of 10 or 20% budget cuts and what can't.
The New York Times has an interesting observation today. It says some of the most liberal members of Congress see the cuts as a rare opportunity to whittle down Pentagon spending. The poor are already shielded from the worst of the cuts, says the Times, and the process could take pressure off the Democratic Party, at least in the short run, to tamper with Social Security and Medicare. At the same time, the president gets some relief from the constant drumbeat of budget news to focus on his top policy priorities, immigration and gun control. What do you think about that analysis, and are you in that camp?
Yeah, I read that article this morning, and I'm still searching for those members that they're talking about. I mean, I don't hear a lot of public or private celebration from, so-called liberal members of Congress that want deep defense cuts, because although it's true that these automatic spending cuts don't hit Medicare and Social Security as deeply, they do hit them. It's a 2% cut in Medicare rates, which comes to, frankly, a time where a lot of hospitals and nursing homes and doctors can't take a 2% cut. But they hit the poor in all sorts of other ways. I mean, you know, the education programs and housing programs and food security programs in the budget that are, you know, keeping people alive and educating, you know, kids take the 8%, 10% whack that every other account does. So it's just not true. And, you know, from Connecticut's standpoint, those defense cuts could really hurt. We saw a 22% curtailment in defense contracting in the fourth quarter of last year, which most economists suggest is the reason why our economy grew at a 0.1% rate. And for Connecticut, if we see, you know, another few months of that kind of restrained defense spending, that has all sorts of social costs to it, because when, you know, people get laid off from their defense sector jobs, then they can't put food on the table for their kids or afford preschool or daycare. And so, you know, there's not a separation between the spending you're doing on the defense accounts and your concern for the welfare of the most vulnerable.
Is that in the New London area where most of those defense cuts will be felt?
No, it's all over the state because, you know, obviously we've got big prime contractors in the state, you know, whether it's Electric Boat in, you know, New London or Sikorsky or Pratt & Whitney. But, you know, you'd be shocked at how many small manufacturers throughout Fairfield County, you know, in the Bridgeport and Norwalk area are making parts for submarines and for jet engines and for helicopters. And so, you know, Connecticut is has a bigger percentage of its economy that relies on manufacturing than the overall average of the nation, in part because we've got so many of these small shops that are hurting right now and could be hurting worse because of the work they do for the Defense Department.
Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut with us. And listeners, where are you on the sequester as of right now? Are you on one side or the other? 212-433-WNYC. Is the president right to be calling for more tax increases right after the fiscal cliff deal with the Bush tax cuts expiring on some of the wealthiest Americans? Where are you on this fraught set of budget cuts with the weird name sequester that were never supposed to take effect anyway? 212-433-WNYC. Do some of you identify with what the Times described as the position of some of the most liberal Democrats, like, oh, okay, maybe not so bad. Let's see what happens. Or anywhere else that you are, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Here's a little bit of where Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is. He said this yesterday, his take on the president's position.
Replacing spending cuts that both parties already agreed to and to which the president already signed into law with tax hikes is simply unacceptable.
Senator Murphy, what do you mean by replacing spending cuts that both sides already agreed to?
Well, again, as I, you know, as I sort of explained in part, these spending cuts, you know, were, quote, never supposed to happen, unquote, in the, you know, words of the people who agreed to them. I was not one of them, because they were just supposed to essentially be a threat that would cause this super committee to come up with a set of cuts and tax increases that would be more reasonable. And so the idea was you made this sequestration, these sets of cuts and sequestration, so terrible and unthinkable that the super committee would say, okay, instead of that, we're going to come up with a deal that will be both revenue and spending decreases. And that was always the agreement, was that we were going to replace sequestration with something that the super committee did that was more reasonable, that had revenue as part of the equation. So for McConnell to come back and say, well, we agreed on sequestration, and so how dare the president talk about replacing these automatic cuts with a mixture of cuts and revenue increases. Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually not what the deal was. The deal was is that these would just be the unthinkable alternative to a more balanced approach. And what we're saying is let's have a more balanced approach. Let's do a little bit of both, as I think most, you know, people in Connecticut and across the country, you know, want to do.
Well, if you think people aren't engaged in this discussion, our lines filled up immediately.
Great.
When we put out the call. So let's talk to Anthony in Bergen County. Anthony, you're on the air. Hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Actually, I'm an elected official, by the way, but that's in here in Jersey. And
you're a local official?
Yeah. And so they want to have the sequestration. Who put it forward? It was the president. Now it's time to take the medicine. I mean, it seems to me in Washington they only get anything done when they're held over the bridge. And so now this is what's going to happen. It's not the best course to go to, but what has to happen, right? And I would tell you from my experience in government, whenever you make a cut anywhere, everyone has the sky's going to fall attitude. So it's a tough decision. It has to be, something has to be done. And it can't be, well, let's keep on raising taxes and taxes and taxes. I mean, you have to cut somewhere, and we all know that from our home budgets.
Do you think, and I don't know what level of government you're in, but do you think that there's going to be an impact on your constituents?
No. There will not. And if it is, again, something has to be done. When you make a cut somewhere, it doesn't matter to what. It could be the dog catcher. I mean, someone's going to suffer. If we're trying to not have anyone suffer, well, then...
And so to the president's point about a balanced approach where, he'll agree to lots of cuts if there's also revenue because the deficit is that big, and so they need a balanced approach.
Yeah, and didn't they have time to do that? So I don't understand. You know what I mean? It's just so now here we are, zero hour. Mm-hmm. Let it roll.
Anthony, thank you very much. So kind of to his point, Senator, politically speaking, both sides seem to be calculating that – they're going to let it roll, that you'll have a stronger hand once the cuts kick in. The Republicans think they'll have a stronger hand once the cuts kick in. How confident are you that the Democrats will?
Well, I'm not. I mean, I just don't think of this politically. I mean, that may be how some people are thinking about it. It's not how I think about it. As I said, I thought this was a dumb idea to begin with, and I continue to think that it's a dumb idea. I think that we should sit down at the table right now and either postpone these cuts, because I disagree with Anthony, and most economists disagree. In fact, I'd say most all economists disagree. This is going to have a pretty serious impact on his constituents. I just came from a hearing with a Democratic economist and a Republican economist in which the Democratic economist said it was going to curtail GDP by one full percentage point. And the Republican economist said, no, you're wrong. It's going to curtail GDP by a half a percentage point. Either one of them are terrible for an economy that is already struggling to get back on its feet. So I don't really think too much about what the political consequences of this are. I just think we should, you know, find a way either by postponing it for a couple of months or by coming up with an alternative that makes more sense so that it doesn't go into effect. I'll be tomorrow at Tweed Airport in New Haven, Connecticut, an airport that will virtually be shut down. 120 jobs connected to that airport, which will be shut down by sequestration because we are not going to be able to afford to pay the air traffic controllers. And when you can't afford to pay air traffic controllers at a small regional airport, you can't really afford to run the place. And frankly, in Anthony's section of New Jersey, whether it's an airport or a Head Start center or a first grade classroom, there are going to be major impacts to employment because of this.
Why would that airport have to shut down right away? I thought if there are going to be furloughs of air traffic controllers or anybody else, that they have to give 30 days notice before, you know, the furlough actually takes effect, and the 30 days notice wouldn't start until the sequestration budget kicks in tomorrow. Is that wrong?
No, and part of it is they're trying to shift people around. So, you know, in an effort to keep Bradley Airport open and running, they need to move folks around from other airports. And so there's going to be some fairly immediate impacts here. And, you know, maybe some of them will take a couple weeks to take effect. But right now, you know, as I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., it doesn't look like there's any immediacy to fixing this problem that'll stop it from lingering for more than a couple of weeks. And what we saw last quarter was that in anticipation of sequestration, the Defense Department just stopped buying things because they didn't think they were going to be able to continue to pay for contracts. So as I said, a 22% reduction in defense purchasing in the fourth quarter, even without sequestration in place. And so there's a multiplier effect here that even if some of these cuts, you know, these layoffs don't happen for another couple of weeks, folks are just going to stop purchasing things for the airport, for instance, which will have a pretty immediate ripple effect into the economy.
Annette in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Annette.
Hi, I'm a constituent of Chris Murphy, and I'd like to say thank you for doing a good job and getting out there and swinging for the Democrats. I would just like to make a comment and say that it is unconscionable of the Republicans. It's irresponsible, unconscionable that they would refuse to grant more revenue from richer people to at least increase taxes to some degree. I had a guy spray my house for bugs, and this guy makes $500 a week, and he takes home $250. It's unconscionable of the Republicans, and I certainly hope that somebody will establish a super PAC so that we can go after these guys in the next election cycle and out them.
Annette, what would you say to this part of the Republican position? And that's that the president just got his tax hikes in the fiscal cliff deal on New Year's. The Bush tax cuts expired for the top earners over $400,000 or $450,000, as you know. Now it's time, they say, for spending cuts, and too soon for more tax hikes. Would they have a point to you, Annette?
No, they don't, because the guys at the top don't pay 40%. They're paying 50% on their capital gains. They're paying
15%. Yeah.
They have, the tax code is full of loopholes. Fix the tax code. Get the guys who should pay what they should pay to pony up. It's not rocket science. And the Republicans are sticking their heads in the sand.
Annette, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Senator Murphy, in our remaining time, I actually want to go to another issue or two. You seem, as a freshman in only your second month in office, to be one of the leaders on the gun control issue. And obviously, Newtown happened in your state. The Danbury News Times even had a headline the other day, Chris Murphy taunts the NRA again. Is that the kind of headline you're seeking?
Well, you know, there is sort of this tradition in the Senate that as a first-term freshman, you're supposed to sort of sit back and, you know, watch the process and learn and not jump in until your sixth month or ninth month. And I have clearly violated that rule, and I violated it for a good reason, because the families in Newtown, Connecticut, need an active voice down here that's going to be part of the process of passing sensible gun reform that will make it less likely that any community ever has to go through what Newtown has and is going through today. I'm a big part of this. And I have, you know, learned over the past 2 months that the NRA needs to be taken down a notch in terms of their influence over the process here in order to get something to pass. And for a long time, members of Congress have been scared of these guys, haven't been willing to call them out, both for, you know, who they represent, which is not common sense gun owners. They represent the gun industry. And for their, you know, relatively meager political power compared to what they advertise. They lost 13 of the 16 Senate races that they spent money in 2012. Nobody really needs to be scared of these guys if you're not with them 100%. And so, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm taunting the NRA. I don't know if I'm criticizing them, but I'm certainly been probably the, you know, loudest thorn in their side over the past 2 months, because I want to get a bill passed that honors the memories of those kids and adults in Newtown, Connecticut. And one of the ways you do that is by calling out the NRA for really what they've become, which is a fringe element of the debate here.
So how close to universal background checks do you think you'll come? That should be the easiest measure to get, but I've heard analysis in the last few days that even that may not be able to pass. How much do you think you can get?
I think we can get universal background checks, as a sign of, you know, how distant from reality the NRA has become in the wake of the Columbine tragedy, when LaPierre came to the Judiciary Committee and said the NRA supports universal background checks, period, stop. Today he comes to the Judiciary Committee and says the NRA opposes background checks, period, stop. It's tougher to get a deal done when they're putting that kind of pressure on Republicans and some Democrats, but I think we'll be there. And frankly, I think that won't be the end. I mean, I think we'll get a bill that provides for universal or near universal background checks, a bill that creates a federal prohibition on gun trafficking, which amazingly there is not today. And I think we will be able to get a ban on these high-capacity magazines. That's the most difficult part here, as well as the assault weapons ban, but I'm working very hard on trying to get some consensus on these 30-round and 100-round magazines, which just have no place in civil society.
One of my concerns about the background checks is that universal really has to be universal. Otherwise, if it's just closing the gun show loophole, as some people put it, then you can still allow private sales in people's homes, and then I fear that the gun show loopholes would just become the home show loopholes, and you'd have AR-15 parties like people used to have Tupperware parties.
Yeah, you got to make it universal, and frankly, you know, there is overwhelming public support for that. 90 plus percent of Americans want universal criminal background checks.
I've seen those surveys, and it's multiple surveys, and 70% of NRA members.
Well, I've seen surveys that say 88% of NRA members want universal background checks, and so it is simply the NRA which argues the other way. And it's pretty amazing that, you know, Congress could be still debating something that 90% of Americans agree on. But that is, you know, a symbol of, you know, how closely the Republican Party listens to the NRA. And we've got this ridiculous rule in the Senate whereby we need 60 votes to pass anything. So it means that even though we've got a majority for universal background checks, we need to get five Republicans to join us. And it's tough finding five Republicans that'll break from the gun lobby.
Last thing. I see you're on the Foreign Relations Committee. That is accurate, right? So do you have a reaction to Secretary of State Kerry's announcement today that the U.S. will begin for the first time to provide what they call non-lethal aid to the Syrian rebels? President Obama has resisted this until now.
Yeah, you know, I'll have to, you know, take a look at exactly what they're proposing. I have generally believed that we can do more to intercede in Syria. A, it's a matter of civil rights, protecting these people who have been killed and battered by the regime. But it's also a question of how America wants to be perceived when this thing gets all sorted out. If we have been perceived to have been on the sidelines when Assad falls and a new regime comes into power, then we have very little leverage with that new administration, and potentially the ramifications for the United States amongst the public, given that perception of sitting on the sidelines, is really damaging to us. So I think it's important to step up here, and I'll take a look at exactly what Kerry is unveiling, but I would guess that it's a step in the right direction.
Chris Murphy, up from the House now to the Senate after the November election. Thanks so much for coming on with us. Good luck again in office. We hope to talk to you many times.
Look forward to it, Brian. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Dennis Kimbrough, author of The Wealth Choice, Success Secrets of Black Millionaires. He has a survey of black millionaires in this book, and you'll be surprised at how little they spend on housing, for one thing. Stay with us.